Production support for Earth Eats comes from Needmore Coffee Roasters, a woman-owned coffee bar and roastery dedicated to roasting organic, direct trade, and fair trade coffee from small-scale farmers around the world. On the east side of Bloomington, corner of Pete Ellis and Longview, needmoreroasters.com. And Charles Schwab & Company Incorporated, with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington.
Looking for areas where there's water and favorable soil temperatures. That's one thing. We want certain types of trees. I've been finding a lot this year at the base of sycamores in creek bottoms.
Ryan Hines is talking about hunting for morels. He's a very serious hobby forager, and he's going to take us on a mushroom hunt today. I'm Annie Corrigan. Hi there. On our ingredients list with Chef Daniel Orr, 8 eggs, a block of Parmesan cheese, and, oh, okay, some gorgeous fresh rainbow Swiss chard. And from Harvest Today, the next story in their series called United and Divided, we meet immigrants in rural Colorado who are working to become U.S. citizens. We're giving the news kids a break this week. You can read some stories on the website, though. The Trump administration has delayed a rule that would have required some restaurants to list calorie counts on menus. Instead of going into effect this week, it's now pushed back to May of next year. Read that at eartheats.org. We're now going to hand it over to Peggy Lowe of Harvest Public Media. She sat down with Sonny Perdue, who was sworn in last week as President Trump's new agriculture secretary. The former Georgia governor will be confronting two important issues in his new job, climate change and immigration reform.
President Trump has promised to dismantle U.S. infrastructure aimed at combating climate change and has even suggested that global warming is a hoax. Perdue, however, says he does believe in climate change and that he wants to run the agency on, quote, sound science, not studies with, quote, an ideological bent.
I've been on a farm since the early 50s, and I can tell you the climate is changing, but the fact of what are the cause of it is really what is in dispute. And some of the things we've done from man-made causes, I think, are very unproductive. So the science, we don't know definitively, in my opinion, what is causing climate change. Many people feel like, from a scientific basis, that it's settled. I don't agree with that.
In fact, most climate scientists agree that the main cause of global warming is human-caused greenhouse gas emissions.
I believe there are things that we can do that make sense to contribute to clean water, clean air, and a better environment on our farms and our fields and our forests that we ought to do irrespective of what the cause of climate change is. And that's what we'll be doing.
But yet you say that you're going to get rid of a lot of those onerous regulations.
Onerous regulations that are not contributive to better environment. Some of them are onerous because they're not effective.
Perhaps the biggest surprise from my talk with Perdue was this. He's working with President Trump to develop new immigration policy that would allow some immigrant ag workers to stay in the U.S. This, of course, after Trump promised during the campaign to deport millions. Perdue told me that Trump recently met with farmers and understands the difficulties of filling jobs on dairies, row crop farms, orchards, and meat plants.
He understands that they are long-term immigrants, sometimes undocumented immigrant laborers out here on the farms, many of them that are doing a great job contributing to the economy of the United States. That is not his focus, nor will that be my focus. In fact, I've hired a lady to come to work, a labor lawyer who had been at Farm Bureau, to help us design a program. I'm hoping we can provide the president and his administration a blueprint and a program of how we can separate and divide and understand who are the immigrants that are contributing to the American society. But he has no desire to remove people who are contributing to the economic society here, nor do I.
So that sounds like a pathway to citizenship for, say, agricultural workers.
Those are your words, not mine.
Okay, but it does sound like you're going to come up with some sort of legal solution to help undocumented workers who are here working on farms and within the agricultural industry to stay here.
I think the president wants to distinguish between the people who are contributing productively, particularly in the agricultural sector, here, have been here for a long while, that maybe might have sponsors that can testify and vouch on their behalf and determine that. We're way early in that process. I can't talk about a path to citizenship or anything like that. We don't know what it will be like. I'm trying to describe the heart of the president and my heart regarding how we treat people. Some people here who are undocumented, who've been working in the United States for a number of years, those people are different than the criminal people, illegal criminals preying on the population of the United States of America.
We can expect a lot more change as Sonny Perdue gets to work as the new Ag Secretary. Already, he has announced rollbacks to the Obama administration's rules on school lunches. And coming up, negotiations for a new farm bill, a piece of legislation that will put the Trump stamp on food policy for years to come. Peggy Lowe, Harvest Public Media.
Harvest has posted a video that goes in depth into Sonny Perdue's background. Watch it at harvestpublicmedia.org. I've eaten plenty of potatoes au gratin at Pitchin's over the years. Delicious, cheesy, baked potatoes, so good. That's the way we're making our recipe today, but no spuds. Chef Daniel Orr's got some fresh greens from his garden. The idea here, and all month actually, will be to give you new recipes for some of your old favorite veggies that maybe have become a little boring over the years. Next week it'll be asparagus, then cauliflower and carrots. So our green of choice today is Swiss chard, leaves, stems, and all.
You know, usually they think, oh, we'll just cook it down like greens. But it's a very different type of vegetable because it has this really colorful, especially the rainbow Swiss chard, has a really colorful stems. And it's funny because here in America, a lot of people eat the leaves and they throw away the stems. Where in Europe, they eat the stems and throw away the leaves. So it's just, you know, a different continent, different concept. So I'm just going to cut the stems into about quarter-inch pieces. Okay, we're gonna rough chop the greens.
You're using a lot of Swiss chard, but this is gonna cook down.
This is gonna cook down. Everything, you know, anytime you look at greens, they always look like a lot. But it also brings up a good point. When you have this much greens, you would tend to, like say if you're making a salad, you'd say, oh, well, you know, I need a lot of seasoning for it. You have to be very careful when seasoning greens because there's a lot of air that gives you the volume. And so it's easy to oversalt and overseason, things like that.
He blanched the chard in some salted, boiling water and shocked them in cold water. Be sure to wring out the greens.
If you don't, it's going to make your gratin very, very watery. So you really want to get that extra excess liquid out. And you can see it's probably less than a quarter of what we started out with.
It's the size of a softball.
Right. And before it was what, size of a basketball?
Or bigger.
All right. Okay, we're going to start adding our other ingredients. And so we're going to add some bacon. Now, if you're vegetarian, probably want to leave that out.
It's good advice.
But you could put, if you wanted that kind of saltiness, you could put some capers in there. You could put some chopped olives in there. Okay, we added some lemon zest, thyme leaves, fresh thyme leaves. Okay, then we've got some eggs. We've got 8 whole eggs. Stir that up. Get those eggs all broken in there. So the next ingredient, bechamel sauce. Now, bechamel sauce, if you don't know, it's a white creamy sauce. It's one of what we call in cooking mother sauce. And the way you remember your mother sauce is there are 5 mother sauces, and you remember TV in bed. So TV, tomato velouté, bed, bechamel espagnol demi-glaze. And bechamel is very simple. Basically, if you've ever had biscuits and gravy, you've had bechamel sauce. It's a milk sauce. So what you do, for this amount, we made 3 cups of bechamel. So it's 1/4 cup of butter, 1/4 cup of flour. You cook those down to make a roux. And that's just melting the two together and cooking it to cook out some of the starches. And then you add 3 cups of milk to that, and you cook that for about 10 to 15 minutes to kind of get that starchiness out of it, and that's your white sauce. Now, if you're going to make a sausage gravy out of it, you just add sausage to that. Okay, so we're going to stir that bechamel in there. Okay, we're going to add Parmesan cheese.
Oh, that's a lot of cheese.
Well, this is a lot of gratin. These are the breadcrumbs that I'm putting on top of the gratin. And then I'm going to top it with a little more cheese. And then we're going to toss that in the oven and cook it until it's hot in the middle and bubbly. It's about 15, 20 minutes, and we've got a wonderful gratin de blette, or Swiss chard gratin.
The recipe and some beautiful pictures snapped by Aobon Binder at eartheats.org. Coming up, we're going into the woods to do some serious morel foraging. But before we leave the kitchen, I had to get Chef Bob Atkins in on this. He's the guy at Farm Bloomington who brings in loads of ramps and morels every spring. You think maybe he'd tell me where he finds all those wild goodies?
People have been shot for less than that.
Whatever, I had to try. Chef Bob is also the executive chef at the restaurant. Maybe the thing is that there is no secret to finding morels, but you can set yourself up for success by doing your homework.
Watch the weather, scout early, you gotta find the trees. You don't really look at the ground, like true morel hunters, which I'm not an old guard at it. But the more that I go, and the more often that I talk to people, they say look for the trees. So elm, ash, to a lesser extent, poplar, tulip poplars, and sycamores. Springtime, 70 degree days, lots of rain, and at least 50 degree nights. But if it gets too hot, they won't work. They have a certain temperature they hatch the fruit in. So I'll use my instant read thermometers and check the soil temperatures. 50 degrees is about when they'll start shooting up the fruiting bodies. Early on, south-facing slopes heat up quicker because they get more sunlight. And you have to be super quiet. Sneak up on them, and they know. They do. They will shoot back down in the ground if you're not quiet.
Well, we'll see if that last part is true or not when we hunt for morels with Ryan Hines in just a bit. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Urgent Foods, a locally owned food truck offering gourmet choices for all lifestyles, tastes, and diets. From gluten-free to kosher and halal, food for everyone, everywhere, full menu, and truck location available at urgentfoods.com. Elizabeth Rue, enrolled agent and owner of Personal Financial Services, providing tax preparation for individuals and businesses, located on the Beeline Trail. More information at personalfinancialservices.net. And Need More Coffee Roasters, a woman-owned coffee bar and roastery dedicated to roasting organic, direct trade, and fair trade coffee from small-scale farmers around the world. On the east side of Bloomington, corner of Pete Ellis and Longview, needmoreroasters.com. I'm Annie. This is Earth Eats. Many immigrants here in the U.S. are worried that changes to immigration policy pushed by the Trump administration could impact their families. And that's just as true in rural America as it is in cities. As part of Harvest Public Media's series United and Divided, Luke Runyon brings us to a rural community and introduces us to the immigrants who want to become U.S. citizens.
Good morning. How are you?
Marisa Velasquez welcomes a group of students to the public library in the Morgan County town of Brush, Colorado. It's about 90 miles northeast of Denver.
Okay, we're going to go ahead and get started.
It's a sunny Saturday morning, and today marks the halfway point in Velasquez's citizenship class. It's a 10-week crash course on American history, civics, and English.
Okay, Congress makes the laws in the United States.
Every student has the same goal, become an American citizen. And if you ask Velasquez, she's surprised to even be here.
And I never thought I was going to teach a class because I took the class as a student.
Velasquez has lived here for 15 years, but only became a naturalized citizen last year. She took this very same course in preparation for her final test. It's a series of questions about the U.S., a dictation exam, and an interview in English.
So that's where we get to practice listening skills, writing skills, reading, so that they're ready for when they go for their interview to become a citizen.
This year, Velasquez has 21 students. In a rural area like Morgan County, that's huge. Like a lot of rural communities centered around meatpacking plants and dairy farms, there are big immigrant and refugee populations here.
So we have students from Mexico, from Guatemala, El Salvador, and then he is from Ethiopia. So some of them are refugees.
There's a lot of fear in the community.
Lisa Prey is the only immigration lawyer in Morgan County. Since the presidential election, she's noticed more of her clients asking about citizenship. Usually, people would just come to her office when they had a relative back home they wanted to bring to the U.S.
Now, what I'm hearing from people is, I just want to make sure I get to stay.
When President Donald Trump began signing executive orders on immigration and international travel earlier this year, Prey says Morgan County's immigrant population was shaken. And while some fear still exists, it's acted as a motivator.
This is one of the big benefits associated with becoming a U.S. citizen. You can't be deported.
Mark Hugo Lopez is director of Hispanic research at the Pew Research Center. He says the number of people seeking citizenship typically peaks when the application fee is set to rise, or during an election year. In 2016, roughly 1 million people applied to be naturalized citizens, the highest in nearly a decade. But Hugo Lopez says there are still millions of eligible immigrants who are not seeking citizenship.
Now, many of them, when you ask them, will say they want to become one, but they also will cite reasons like not only the cost and language being potential barriers, but they will also say, for example, they're busy, they're working, they don't have the time, they haven't even thought about it.
Back at the public library, class is about to wrap up. In a span of 2 hours, instructor Marisa Velasquez has covered voting rights, the legislative process, grammar, even which month Flag Day is in.
Okay, Flag Day is in June.
This week's homework is to study up on amendments to the Constitution, all 27 of them. Another question on the citizenship test. I chat briefly with one student, Kibram Baraki, a refugee from Eritrea. Like every other student, he's already a legal permanent resident. He works at the nearby meatpacking plant, hanging cow heads for hours each workday.
Why did you sign up for this class?
Because it's almost time coming in America. It's 5 years. And that's why I take a class. After I did a citizenship, I get a great job and a good life.
Get a great job and a good life. Baraki says that's the opportunity America has given him. Luke Runyon, Harvest Public Media.
Listen to more stories from the United and Divided series at harvestpublicmedia.org. The season for morels is a short one, and it's temperamental. The conditions have to be just right for these little mushrooms to fruit. And that makes it sort of hard to do a story about it, because I tagged along with a forager 1 week, and then the next we get torrential downpours and the mushrooms retreat. I guess that's just the way it goes with natural things. And that's honestly part of what makes morels so magical. Here one day, gone the next. Every spring, I like to try my luck at finding morels, and I've only ever been sort of successful. Like, once I harvested enough for breakfast for 2 people. But that, I remember, was so exciting. I even get a rush of adrenaline when I see pictures of morels. This year, it was April 6th when I saw my very first morel picture on Instagram. It was on Ryan Hines' account. He's a PhD candidate at Indiana University School of Public Health, so I knew that he was foraging in areas near me. And then 2 more pictures popped up that same day. Ryan clearly was living the dream, a hobby forager who seems to find morels as often as he wants.
Well, let's hop in.
So we met up to go on a hunt together.
Okay, so I guess the first question I always ask in situations like this is, where are we going? But you're probably not going to tell me.
Well, we're going to go to the Hoosier National Forest.
to a spot that I've been, an area that I've been scouting. This particular place that we're gonna go, we're gonna hike up a nice little creek bed that all signs point to yes.
That narrows it down to somewhere in the 200,000 plus acreage that is the Hoosier National Forest in southern Indiana. And that's as specific as we're gonna get. Ryan got very specific when he chose our spot for the day. He knows that morels like to pop up when an area has gotten 1.5 to 2 inches of rain. So he looks at the 7-day, 14-day, 30-day rainfall trends. Ground temperature is also key. 50 to 60 degrees is ideal for most types of morels. Then he wanted a water source and slopes that provide shade. He also looks for certain types of plants and, of course, trees. And then there are some unorthodox methods.
My buddy Chris and I have it started out as a turtle hypothesis, but now it's reptile hypothesis. Whenever we get into an area where we're seeing lots of box turtles that are either emerging or out or mating, those are warm areas because they're cold-blooded, so they're tuned in to where is it warm.
No wonder you're so successful. Look at all this work you do. Did I just jinx us?
No. No. Although, I couldn't find I won't call it my lucky mushroom bag, but I'll call it my preferred mushroom bag. That's okay.
Ryan started foraging for mushrooms in Georgia 9 years ago, moved to Indiana 5 years ago, and kept up the hobby. During peak season, he's out in the woods looking for morels every day, sometimes multiple times a day. In the car with us was someone like me, who's lived in Indiana longer than Ryan, but has had much less success finding morels. Kate Young of Mother Hubbard's Cupboard dropped everything that day to join us. She also feels the emotional pull of the mushrooms.
1 year, I found quite a few, I would say maybe a dozen. And I was really bitten by the morel hunting bug that year and just thought, okay, I can do this. And we've gone back to that same spot year after year at peak morel season and have not had any luck.
You know, for me, so I've had the experience, I have a spot, and I think I'm like you, where like I go back to that spot and I find some, but I also find people, which is not good for a morel spot. But when I don't find them, and I know they should be there, I feel like an utter failure.
Yes. Yes, I feel that way too. My partner, Carl, also, he just gets really down if he's like, I know they're here, why don't we have any?
Yeah, blue. I get blue.
Yeah,
like
blue.
Yeah.
I would say I'm blue right now. I went out Friday and was somewhat successful. Saturday, somewhat successful. Yesterday, found one.
What, are we talking literally one?
One single, yes. So, yeah, excited to get out and see if all of my data collecting and scouting and intuition might pay off.
Hoosier National Forest is public land, so we're allowed to collect mushrooms for personal use, but not to sell. No problem there. We want to eat our spoils. It was a warm April afternoon, very sunny.
Have you been out here already?
I've been coming here pretty consistently. We're going to visit an area or a specific creek that I haven't walked up.
Okay, let's do this.
Let's do it. So for this first little part, we will serve ourselves well if we resist the urge to look until we're in our, to the beginning of our target zone. Target zone, attack! So we'll take a left here.
We're on a very narrow trail that takes us by a lake. Ryan has a compass and a mesh bag. He's leading us to a creek bed that he scoped out. Once there, we start looking for specific plants. Ramps, May apples, trillium, bloodroot, all of those like the same growing conditions as morels. Then, of course, he points out trees, elm trees in particular. The leaves are distinctive, with a curve in the center vein, and one side of the leaf always being a little longer than the other. The bark on an elm tree is in a Y pattern, and around here, elms are everywhere.
Live, dead, dying elm is probably the most consistently cited spot for, okay, where are we finding them, or where do you look? Look under elms. So if you're scouting areas, which a lot of the time spent finding morels or other favorable areas is scouting when it's not the season, looking for areas where there's water and we want certain types of trees. And so really, till you get out and start looking and just try your hand and try your luck, there's only so much information that can be helpful.
Well, I'm walking slowly and then I'm stopping and I'm scanning all around me. But I have had the experience of being squatted down for a long time in one spot and then all of a sudden seeing one and realizing that it's been sitting right by my foot all along, and then seeing another and just being like, what? How could this be right in front of me? I'm looking for it and I still didn't see it.
So have already briefly scoured up, scoured this area, but clearly walked right by that one a few days ago.
Oh my gosh!
Right. And there's another one right behind you, Annie.
So, oh my gosh!
Where? Where's
this?
Oh, there's one.
Oh my god! Whoa! How could I have missed that?
Oh boy.
It's enormous.
Ryan joked about his Terminator vision, but being there with him, that wasn't a joke. He spotted 6 morels over the course of our 3 hours together, and then into the mesh bag they go, so that as we continue walking, the spores will drop out, and maybe, just maybe, fruit more morels next year. Kate, on the other hand, continues to slowly and methodically scour the area.
I don't know if discouraged is the right word, but just kind of accepting the fact that I'm probably not going to find one on my own today. But I still feel thrilled that some were found.
Oh! Oh! What?
With all this rain and the cooler temps that we've had in May, will we see another flush of morels this season? Well, Ryan says he's not especially optimistic, but you'd better believe he'll be doing his research just in case. Don't feel too bad for Kate. She took the morels home and pan-fried them. Her recipe is at eartheats.org. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Charles Schwab & Company Incorporated, with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Urgent Foods, a locally owned food truck offering gourmet choices for all lifestyles, tastes, and diets, from vegetarian to paleo and low carb. Taste matters, your taste. Current truck location is available at whereisurgent.com. And Elizabeth Rue, enrolled agent and owner of Personal Financial Services, providing tax preparation for individuals and businesses, located on the Beeline Trail. More information at personalfinancialservices.net. Okay, thanks for listening. I'm Annie Corrigan.